Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime.
We are back.
Hey guys, Lena has her hair curled, so she's got a hot date after this.
With the recliner and the TV.
Yes, that is a hot date. Yeah. That's my favorite date.
This curl is from yesterday.
Oh.
From church.
Wow. It's really hanging on.
Yeah, it does pretty good.
I love it. I think a slept-in curl is prettier than a fresh curl.
Yeah, I agree with you.
It's like, what, this whole thing?
I know.
I didn't even do this. I just woke up like this.
Exactly. Yeah, pretty much.
How was Oklahoma?
It was really good. Downtime and seeing our precious Grammy.
Yes, I miss her.
Yes, got to give her a hug and see her smiling face. Aww. So, yeah.
Love her. I got to get up there. It's just that, you know, we're back in a cast. And
yeah. So you had a lot going on and I have not even talked to you.
Guys, this is not therapy hour, but like my littlest twin is back in a Spica cast. It was just the right thing to do for her and another 6 weeks of this mess. It's, you know, I'm thankful in a lot of ways. I'm thankful for her surgeon who's very proactive and he's like, let's not spend any more time like in physical therapy with this going on.
Yeah.
And just hope it gets better. Let's just do it now. And so what happened was, is like her left leg didn't come out of the socket again. It was just kind of, she was in a weird position. She didn't want to move her leg.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just wanted to get it set back in the cast so she could kind of start over and like reset. So,
okay.
Anyways, it's okay. I had a very difficult time like with it.
Well, how did
Poppy nearly took my head off?
Did she really? That I was about to ask, how did she handle it?
So, the doctor came in and he kind of sat down and, you know, told me. So, I've been thinking a lot about it and we need to do a cast. And so Poppy was sitting right there in the bed and I was like, did you hear that? You're going to have a cast again when you wake up. And she was like, no,
no, no, I'm not.
She goes, no. And I was like, yeah, baby, you got to. And he was like, well, do you want to pick a color? And she's like, no, no. And he's like, okay. And so I was like, why don't you pick a color? And she goes, okay, green. So she picked green, but when she woke up, she was
mad,
raging. I mean, she tried to tear my face off, basically.
No way.
Like the skin on my face. I thought she was going to peel it off from one side to the
Sweet
other.
Sweet Poppy.
Yes, she was so mad. And like,
do you think it was the anesthesia?
I think it was.
Part of that,
but also like, why are we doing this again?
Yeah.
I do not trust you. Like you have lost all the trust, woman. Oh, and she was like, you know, salty with me the rest of the day. The next day she was, oh my gosh. Our physical therapist came over to do Daisy's physical therapy.
Yeah.
And she goes, Miss Chastity doesn't want to play with me anymore.
Oh,
and like crossed
no.
her arms. And I was like, so she just kept making comments like, I'm in a cast. Like, look at me. I can't walk. She's like, poor
three-year-old
being passive aggressive. It was just,
oh, she knows how to play the game.
Oh, my gosh.
Aw, poor thing.
She's in better spirits, though. We've talked a lot about it. And, you know, she's getting all the attention. So she's down for that.
No.
You know, it's just hard. So,
yeah.
Yeah. That's what's been going on with me. What's been going on with you? I don't see any new deers in here. So
no, I hadn't put the other one up yet. I don't know if I'm going to, but yeah, no, that's the only one for now. Yeah.
Should we talk about the weather though?
Yes, please.
Oh, that's a sigh of relief. That's
maybe we should be recording outside.
Oh man. Tweet, tweet. All yeah. the birds in the background. That would be amazing. Oh, it's September and it might as well be October.
Yeah.
I've got my pumpkins out. I finally found them. And oh, I'm just like, oh, should I put my jack-o'-lanterns up?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, you should. Yeah, I've been sitting outside as much as I can. So
yes, it's so nice outside. Mm-hmm. I mean, 88 feels like a cool breeze to us, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, this one is going to be a little bit long. This is the conclusion. This is part two. I have many pages of notes to get through.
Well, let's stop chatting and get to it.
Yeah, we better stop chatting. I hope I don't have to make this three parts. I really...
Oh, no.
I would hate to do that.
Well, I won't be talking very much anyway because I've been forewarned.
Well, the way part one went, I mean, this is part two. So if you missed part one, pause and go listen. I'll link it in the show notes. I know how difficult that episode was to listen to.
Mm.
So thank you for returning so we can get this wrapped up. In part one, we talked about Peter Curtin's upbringing and how he was introduced to depravity at a very young age. I mean, he grew up in hell, basically. Yeah. I mean, from his father's parents to his parents, like, it was the worst possible conditions that a child, let alone 13 children,
oh yeah,
should have been raised in.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
You know, the petty crimes he committed and his first kill we also discussed in part one, and the escalation in his sexual violence and deviance. It really gives us insight into why he went down the road he did and how he ended up with such depraved behaviors. Like, I just can't. It's difficult writing about this because it's like
you can't understand.
There are no words
it.
In the thesaurus to describe his behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there just really aren't. And the last thing we discussed was about the string of stranglings, like the strangling attacks. He'd strangle these women and he'd have consensual relations with them, but he wouldn't kill them because right. they wouldn't oppose him. But the thrill of like that spontaneous attack, it was really wild. He would like go out with a woman and they would have consensual sex and then he would just like attack her and rape her on a bench. Like, it's like, why? I mean, you know
control,
what I mean? It's like,
exactly.
That's exactly what it is. He just catching these women off guard was thrilling to him, but it wasn't enough. He could not stop thinking about that first kill. And he wanted to kill again. So February 3rd, 1929. Again, let me rewind. Every trigger warning ever. Sexual assault, violence against children, like everything, it's in it. So there's your warning. Drop the kids off at school and come back to this one.
Mm-hmm.
So February 3rd, 1929. A 55-year-old woman named Frau Kuhn was walking on an isolated road just as the sun was setting in the district of Flingern. I hope I'm saying that right. In Dusseldorf, Germany. The book I mentioned in the previous episode, that was like my primary source. The book refers to her as Frau, but I also saw her called Apollonia.
Oh.
But I'll call her Frau just because... I don't know. I'll lean more towards like a doctor's writing.
Okay.
Over like newspaper reporting.
More professional.
Yeah, I just feel like someone who's trained in scientific research is more concerned about accuracy
sure.
than a
absolutely
maybe a reporter. I don't know. So that's what I'm going with. So she probably walked this route many times.
Mm-hmm.
But this time would be different. before she could even process what was happening to her, she was rushed by a man who grabbed her by the coat and thrust her to the ground. I think we know who the man is. Like, there's no mystery. I'm not
who
even
could
gonna,
it be?
I'm not even going to bury the lead. He, Peter Curtin, mm-hmm. said to her, "Don't scream." But okay. She did scream, as would I. She screamed for her life. She screamed for help and he began stabbing her over and over again with scissors in quick succession. In the head.
Oh, no.
In the torso. Her arms. I mean, she was stabbed at least 24 times. Peter would later say that he set out that night with those scissors in his pocket looking for a victim. So he left the house with those scissors. Wasn't just like...
premeditated.
Yeah, exactly. Everything is premeditated with this guy. Miraculously, Frau Kuhn survived.
What?
I mentioned this in part one, but there's limited information about a lot of Peter's victims. For instance, I would love to give you the details of how Frau was found and her life was saved. I don't know if she was able to like get up and go for help or if someone found her. Unfortunately, I can't give more insight into her case. And I don't know what happened to her after this attack. Like, what were the implications of her injuries?
Mm-hmm.
I imagine 24 stab wounds. She must have had quite the recovery.
For sure.
And she probably had lasting, you know, lasting implications from...
Well, back in the 1920s, I mean, it was far from medical treatment these days.
I mean, just like basic things like Lane.
Yeah.
And the use of his hand. Like, he had one accident, the use of his hand. Think about being stabbed 24 times all over your body. Like, she probably couldn't move a lot of things, and she probably had nerve damage.
Oh,
and, like,
absolutely.
The poor woman. So Dr. Carl Berg, the author of The Sadist, detailed the conversations he had with Peter after his arrest. Spoiler alert. Dr. Berg was a professor of forensic medicine at Dusseldorf Medical Academy. And when Peter Curtin was eventually caught, he was like, "I have got to talk to this guy." I imagine for a clinician, this is like Christmas. When you have heard about someone so, there's no one like him. Like, there's just no one like him. You're even right. To this day, I can't even think of a serial killer that's anywhere near like this guy. So other medical professionals and academics needed to know what this guy's brain was made of.
Oh, yeah.
Pure dirt and just disgust. This was, you know, the early 1930s, and we were decades away from even having criteria for psychopaths. And mm-hmm. I think clinicians were really reluctant to classify these people because that meant there were enough people to classify.
Oh.
And isn't that a scary thought?
Oh, like, man.
Oh, there's this group of people in the world, and we need a criteria for them. We need to call them something.
That is interesting to think about.
So anyway, Peter recounted for Dr. Berg that when he got home from attacking Frau Kuhn, he was cleaning the scissors and he realized the tip of one of the blades had broken off.
Oh.
Peter said, quote, "I noticed that from one blade, the pointed part had been broken off about 8 to 10 millimeters. I had thought the stabs were much deeper," end quote.
Oh.
He sounds disappointed to me.
Yeah.
And here's where his crimes become more sexually motivated, I would say. After leaving Frau to die, he returned to the area twice in the following days and became sexually excited.
Mm.
It was a new way he realized he could enjoy his crimes, by reliving it and getting off on it, because he was a sicko. Now, just 5 short days after he attacked Frau Kuhn, he struck again. Around 9 a.m., February 9th, 1929, some men were walking to work in the Flingern district, spotted something under the bushes, and they were like, It was kind of concealed, but it was striking enough for them to like risk being late for work. They're like, let's go check it out.
Yeah.
As they approached the hedges, they saw the body of a little girl.
No.
Fully clothed in a dress and a cloak, and there was an overwhelming odor of petroleum. She had been burned and she was still smoldering.
No.
Yeah. We've talked about this before. If you want to burn a body beyond recognition, you have to tend to that fire over time. It's not like, you know, when these wildfires spread, it's nothing like that. You have to like keep providing this body with fire. I mean,
yeah. It doesn't just...
Luckily, our bodies are not flammable on their own.
It takes a long time.
But the only burns to the little girl's body were to her clothes, her hair. She wasn't burned all over. Unlike most criminals, getting rid of evidence was not the goal here for Peter.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it.
As we know, he got off on setting fires.
Mm-hmm.
So he lit that child on fire to have a sexual experience. It wasn't to get rid of evidence. It was to be gross. To just be gross. I can't even say it any other way. And let's move on.
Please.
The police soon identified the victim as 8-year-old Rosa Ollinger. And to try and piece together a timeline of how she came to be this way, they spoke with her mother. What was she doing? Like, how did she get out here? So Rosa's mother said that Rosa had eaten sauerkraut, how German of her, I love it, around 2 in the afternoon before going out to visit a friend, a schoolmate. She made it to her friend's house. They played for a bit and they kind of lost track of time. And her friend was like, it's 6 o'clock. You better hurry home. Like, it's getting dark. You better go. So Rosa set out. It was getting dark. But Peter recounted Rosa's death to Dr. Berg in the book, and he kind of lied a little bit, kind of omitted details a little bit. But her autopsy painted a very clear picture of what happened to this poor child. An examination of her stomach revealed partially digested meat and cabbage, so it was decided that she was likely killed between 6 and 7, given that she had eaten what was known to be that at 2 in the afternoon. And according to the medical examiner, she would have died pretty soon after the multiple stab wounds to her left breast, because 5 of those wounds pierced her heart. And it's also believed that she had most likely been, like, she passed out from the strangulation before she was stabbed, because she had no defensive wounds. And with all that said, I can only just pray that she did not suffer through that ordeal. So what did Peter have to say about the murder of Rosa Ollinger? He said that he approached Rosa and she went with him willingly. She was compliant, and that he only stabbed her 3 times before she fell to the ground and didn't move again.
Well,
yeah.
How good
of
you.
Per her autopsy, she was stabbed 13 times in her left breast.
Oh.
And she...
I think he lost count.
Yeah. And she had been sexually assaulted. But as we know, he left out that part.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always amazed when these psychopathic murderers who will admit to the most heinous acts on a victim.
Yeah.
But they will not admit to the sexual assault component.
Mm-hmm.
Because even they know that there's nothing worse than violating someone in that way.
Ugh.
Even they know that. And they don't want that on them.
Yeah.
Anyway, the stab wounds to Rosa's body were very concentrated to that one area. And there was blood pooled in her head, which indicated, like I said, she had also been strangled. Peter left out all these details.
Of course he did.
It was a frenzied stabbing. All of the stab wounds were in the same direction, up and down.
Ah.
So if you think about someone being stabbed all over their body, different depths, different positions. Like, he just stabbed, just frenzied, which speaks to his pathology. Now, after the murder of Rosa Olinger, Peter waited about 5 days. 5 days, cooling off period, that's enough. And then he found his next victim, a 45-year-old mechanic named Rudolph Scheer. Rudolph had stumbled out of a beer house in the Flingern district shortly before being attacked by Peter Curtin. Somewhere between, it was like 11 or 12 at night, Peter approached Rudolph and initiated some sort of altercation. Like, I don't know if he called him a name or whatever, but he got this guy to push him to the ground. So he started a fight. So he ended up stabbing Rudolph again and again right there in the street. And once he realized, oh, I'm kind of making a bit of a mess here.
Oh, you think?
He saw this large pool of blood forming and he was like, I can't do this here. Like, oh, I gotta. So he grabbed Rudolph's feet, pulled him over to a ditch and kind of nudged his body into the ditch so it would roll down into the ditch. As Peter starts hightailing it out of there, he's like, wait a minute, what if my fingerprints are on his shoes? And you know what? This strikes me too, because he never cared about evidence. He never went to any lengths to cover his tracks or distance himself from these crimes. Why care about it
now?
Exactly. So he runs back to the ditch and he goes down and like rubs Rudolph's shoes, like with his shirt or something.
What a weirdo.
Trying to clean off his fingerprints that may or may not be there. 1929. I don't know. Rudolph's body was discovered the next morning around 8 a.m. And even though it was February, this is interesting. You're going to like this. You're not going to like this, but like.
Interesting.
It's interesting. Okay. So it's February. His body was still warm at 8 a.m.
What?
Yeah. Rigor had only just set in.
How is that?
So according to Dr. Berg, because of the amount of alcohol that was in Rudolph's system, it likely slowed his death.
What?
Therefore, delaying, you know, those postmortem changes that we would see or we would expect to see in a body that had been dead that long. You know?
Right.
Peter comes back to the scene of the crime, though.
Yeah.
He's like, what's going on over here? Just like the cafe in part one. He comes back and he sees all this, you know, hustle and bustle. And there was actually a detective coming on scene. Peter starts walking alongside him and engages in the conversation with him. And as soon as this detective sees him, he's like, well, how did you hear about this? Because they had just, walked, you know, the body had just been found. And he goes, oh, well, someone called me. Someone called me to tell me about the body. And so,
interesting.
Yeah. And
how brazen.
I know. I know. And so the detective's like, well, I got to get to work now because like he's up there at the crime scene.
You got to leave.
They're, I don't know, they're like roping it off. And Peter was like, okay, okay. So he just like kind of stopped and couldn't go any further. But he was like just kind of lingering around, you know, shooting the breeze with the other detectives, maybe the people next to him. Do y'all know what happened? Because he thrived off of that.
Oh, yeah.
That was one of his many pleasures. It was just another element of his depravity. I mean, I just can't think of another word for the guy. I think by now the investigators were thinking that the stabbing victims were all attacked by the same person due to the frequency and the proximity of the attacks. But they grew more confident in that theory when Rudolph Scheer's autopsy was performed. He had been stabbed 20 times and 16 of those stab wounds were to his neck.
Oh,
and
my
frenzied.
Goodness.
Very similar to the other victims. Same direction, all but maybe like one or two. The sharp force injuries to the neck were all in a relatively small space. And like I said, all but one of those wounds were horizontal. So the knife was being held in the same way. He wasn't moving.
Okay.
So
all but one was horizontal.
All but one was horizontal. Now, That told investigators that those stab wounds in the same direction were likely made, like I said, frenzied and at a rapid pace. Rudolph had also been stabbed in the temple and in the back, either of which would have been fatal by themselves. Again, with this victim, there are no defensive wounds indicating a rushed attack.
Mm-hmm.
We know he was drunk, so that also lends to why there were probably no defensive wounds, but most of his victims didn't have defensive wounds. He just pounced on them so quickly. It wasn't just the nature of the wounds, like being stab wounds, that seemed to point to one perpetrator in these cases, though. There were other commonalities between the cases. I already mentioned the location. They were all done in the Flingern district.
Mm-hmm.
The time of day, all done at dusk or after dark. And lastly, no real motive. That's the thing.
Yeah.
When you think about a serial killer, they don't really have a motive, do they?
No.
It's a self-satisfaction motive.
Right, that was about
it's
to say.
It's not like that robbery was not a factor. Rosa was sexually assaulted. The others weren't. So these attacks just seemed like for the heck of it. And just like whatever the person felt at the time. At this point, police believed they had a suspect, though.
Ah. They're like, I've got a hunch.
Yeah. A man named Johannes Stalsberg.
Okay.
I don't know if I'm saying that right. I'm sorry to our German listeners. They're going to shut the borders and not let me in November. He'd been linked to attacks on a couple women in the area in April. And both Johannes's victims survived to describe their brutal attacks to police.
And so were the attacks similar? Or are you going to tell me about
them? Yeah, I'm going to tell you about them. And they do sound similar. So the first victim was Erna Penning. She was 16 years old, walking home on her own.
Mm.
She heard someone walking close behind her, and she thought it might be her friend, this girl. Okay, she thinks it might be her friend, so she's like, I'm going to pretend I don't see her. So she flipped her collar up and held her collar like up on each cheek so that her friend, who she thought it was, wouldn't see her. And then she was going to be like, boo, or whatever. Yeah. Instead, someone comes up behind her and slipped a noose over her head.
Oh.
The man tried to tighten the noose. However, because Erna had her hands up by her face, he couldn't tighten the noose.
Wow.
So her being silly saved her life, no doubt.
Love it.
She fought for her life. The man threw her to the ground, tried strangling her, and she was able to squeeze the guy's nose.
Yes,
she, like,
girl.
Let go for 1 second, squeezed his nose, honk, and he was like, ouch, and she just like ran away. Now, 2 days later, a woman named Frau Flake, yes, there's a lot of Fraus, like Fräulein. I think Frau is short for Fräulein.
Okay.
So there's a lot of those people in this story, women. Frau Flake was walking home from work when someone came up from behind her and slipped a noose around her neck.
Uh-huh.
Isn't that freaking scary?
It is.
Now, she was immediately yanked to the ground. She did not have her hands up. And a gag was put in her mouth. Now, Johannes drug her by the noose from the road she was walking on and into a nearby field. He was like, well, I can't strangle this woman right in the street.
No.
Someone's going to see. So he drug her. And as he drug her, the noose was tightening, tightening, tightening. But she was struggling. She was fighting for her life. And she was making such a racket. He was like, someone's going to hear her, so I better just go now.
Yeah.
So he just gave up and like ran away. She didn't know why, but he had saw some people seeing him.
Oh.
So I don't know if they really like got a good look at him,
well,
but they
thank
they heard
God they were
screaming,
there
screaming, and so they started running over to help her. So she was able to free herself and get help. Now the details of these attacks on these two women seems, I mean, other than the noose, they seemed similar to Peter's crimes. Very rushed, very
in public,
but also like at night mm-hmm. and like in a field, you know, trying to be inconspicuous. And it made this Johannes guy look really good for these three murders that happened in February.
Yeah, sounds like it.
There weren't any other violent attacks, nothing like that, that in or around this area at this time. So it was an easy inference to make for police. They're like, this got to be our guy.
But why two different men in the same area? What's going on?
Well, Johannes was 20 years old. Ugh. He had a speech impediment and he had cognitive delays. And when confronted, he confessed to all three murders.
What?
Yeah. Without outright speculating, which I'm going to, it's quite possible that he could have been led by law enforcement. And I'm not saying they intentionally did it.
Okay.
But whether intentional or unintentional, you know, someone with cognitive delays, it's pretty easy to lead them to this, you know.
Yeah, if I say I did it, I'll get off easy or.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They could have, you know, like the Stephen Avery, his nephew.
That's what I'm sitting here thinking.
Am I going to be home in time to watch wrestling?
Right.
That's literally his question. He asked if he was going to be home in time to watch the wrestling.
Exactly.
Because he has no, like, he cannot even fathom or wrap his mind around consequence. Anyway. So he didn't just confess to these murders, but he gave details about the crimes that were quite convincing. Again, he could have been fed this information. Mm-hmm. Like, so when you strangled her, what did you use? Did you use your hands?
Okay.
Yes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that line of questioning that we see and hear so many times in like a false confession. And, oh, well, he had details of the crime.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't have details of the crime. He simply said yes to your leading question. But he also could have heard it from people talking who had read papers because he couldn't actually read himself.
Oh.
So the police were like, he couldn't have read any of these details. But it's like, nobody could have heard people talking about it.
Sure.
So
okay.
He could have had those things in his mind. He got some of the evidence wrong in Rosa Olinger's case, but they had heard enough. Like, they're like, this guy has a propensity for homicidal violence. He's got to be our guy. There's just no other person on the planet that would just do this in this span of time. Like, what are the odds? So they had decided this is our guy, but because he wasn't operating on all cylinders, they felt like prosecuting him wasn't really the answer because he had a speech impediment, couldn't read. He was speaking in like broken sentences. And so they felt like no jury is going to convict this guy. So they sent him to an institution. They sent him to Bedburg Asylum and the cases were seemingly solved.
Oh, okay.
Unfortunately.
Washing their hands of it.
Yeah. And I'm sure they felt really proud of themselves that they had gotten this monster off the street and like no fault of their own.
Right.
Like, you don't think that two people could exist.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, we know that Johannes Stalsberg did not kill those three. And instead of slinking off into the shadows and being like, ha ha, someone's paying for my crimes, Peter kept on keeping on.
Yeah.
He was like,
he's not going to take
murder.
He's not going to take responsibility for my action.
Yeah, exactly. And he wouldn't in the end. He wouldn't let, you know, he was like, no, I did that. Mm. Now, just a couple months after Johannes Stalsberg was put away, there was a string of stabbings in August of 1929. This is just, they're like, uh-oh. Police are like, uh-oh. The community is like, uh-oh. Now, just south but relatively close to the Flinger District, where the three murders were in February, was Lierenfeld. I don't know if I'm saying it right. August 21st, Frau Mattel was walking along a dimly lit road, and she heard something behind her. She heard someone walking next to her, and he said something like, "Can I walk with you, Fräulein?" And when she didn't respond, she was stabbed in the back.
Oh.
The same evening, around the same time, Anna Goldhausen was approached and stabbed between her 6th and 7th ribs, which penetrated her liver and stomach.
Oh.
She lived, but those are serious injuries.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And she had a long road to recovery, I'm sure. A little bit later that night, a man named Heinrich Kornblum was walking, minding his own business, when he was stabbed in the back. Just like one after the other. The book says that Heinrich was wearing braces, which I think are suspenders. That's what they call them in England.
Okay.
So I'm just assuming that they're talking about suspenders. So he had stabbed him in the back through one of the straps of the suspenders, making a perfect knife impression. That 15 millimeter slice that they had measured in his clothing was not made by the same knife that killed the 3 victims in February, which gave confidence to the fact that they were now dealing with a different attacker other than Johannes.
Okay.
And in fact, they called the asylum and they're like, is Johannes still there? Hi, is Johannes there? Can he come out and play? They wanted to make sure the guy was still there. They're like, okay, he's still there.
That's the only explanation at this point.
This is a different weapon, so it's got to be a new guy.
Yeah.
So the violence continued in Dusseldorf. In August, it was a Saturday evening, 5-year-old Gertrude Haymacher, and her older sister, 14-year-old Louisa Lindzen, set out for the market in Flie. In Flie.
I wish y'all could see her face.
Okay. This is no laughing matter, Lena.
Okay.
You need to be mature.
Well, when I look at your face.
I know. So they went out to the market to get some bits, but they never returned home.
Mm.
And their family was immediately concerned. They're like, no, something's wrong. So they immediately went out to search for the girls in and around the marketplace, through the thoroughfare between their home and the marketplace, just anywhere they thought, oh, maybe they could have wandered off this way or that way. But they didn't find them until the next morning.
Oh.
Sunday morning, about 6 a.m., Gertrude's body was found about 200 yards away from her home, laying on the ground amongst some overturned runner beans. Her sister Louisa was just 18 yards from her, face down in a vegetable bed.
No.
They were both fully clothed, but appeared to have been strangled, stabbed repeatedly, and their throats were cut.
I'm so sorry, little angels.
I just, to lose 2 daughters. I can't even. Anyway, police were able to track the shoe prints of a man, what appeared to be a man, and 2 children walking on the road, going from the main road through an alleyway and into a bean patch. So they see these footprints, and then from the bean patch, there's just then 2 sets of footprints.
Oh.
So witnesses claimed that they heard a child screaming, "Mama, Mama," around 9 p.m. the night before, which investigators believe that's probably the time of the attacks and the time of their deaths. But this person didn't investigate. They didn't look and see who's screaming. I mean, would we? I mean, if you hear a child screaming, "Mama, Mama,"
I would hope I would,
you would hope, but I hear kids screaming all the time. So I'm like,
oh, well,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I guess it depends on the day and whatever, but maybe this woman had 5 kids at home and was tuned that out. Yeah. I don't know. And there were others in the area who had heard screams, but they didn't see anything. I mean, it was a marketplace, so there was a lot of people out at that hour, but they didn't see anything because those vegetable patches were on the outside and it was dark.
Yeah.
The town was horrified. I mean, now more children are dying. And to think they could have been in the same vicinity witnessed these murders or heard what was going on and they did nothing. I mean, the other thing is like, why such overkill? Speaking of which, these days we would say that kind of kill, like that kind of feels like overkill.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. That seems personal. Like we would associate overkill, like a stabbing, a shooting, a, you know, like someone's beaten and stabbed and shot. It's like any one of those things would have gotten the job done.
Yeah.
But you've gone to the extreme. And so we always think, oh, that feels personal.
Personal, yeah.
But one, how could an attack on a child be personal? Like what possibly could have a child done to deserve such a thing or warrant that? And two, it's not always personal, you know?
Yeah.
Perhaps we're dealing with someone completely unhinged.
Unhinged, deranged, evil. I mean, bottom line.
Yeah. And the same day those girls' bodies were found, someone else had been attacked. And I will tell you about that in part three. I am so sorry.
Part three.
I'm so sorry.
You said we were going to finish this today.
I did say that. If you're on our Patreon, I will go ahead and upload the third part. I am so sorry that this has to be three parts. It's just for length, and I'm really trying to give as much detail about the victims as I possibly could find.
Okay.
I don't want Peter to shine through here.
No.
Like, it hurts my heart that there is a ton of his victims that just get looped in together. And they deserve to have, like, every stab wound explained, everything they went through explained. And it might be hard for us to hear, but it's, like, nothing compared to what they went through. Mm-hmm. And that's just how I feel about it. And okay. That's why I'm...
Yeah.
Trying to give as much detail on each of the victims as I possibly can. So, and I understand if that's not for you. So.
No, I mean, that's part so of, sorry. That's part of why we do this is to give the victim the respect that they're owed. I know. Well, thank you for doing that. But I'm sad we're going to have to listen to.
I know. One more part, and I promise it's just going to be three parts. I swear to this deer on the wall. I swear to the deer on the wall. It's only going to be three parts.
Okay. Well,
okay, guys.
That was not great. Let's do it again. No,
we'll see you next week, guys.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. Get connected with us by becoming a free member on our Patreon. Or for just $5 a month, you'll have access to bonus episodes, discussion groups, and much more. If you can't afford $5 a month, we get it. Inflation, am I right? Please consider leaving us a positive review and rating wherever you listen.
And don't forget merch. Support our podcast and show the love by sporting t-shirts with our latest designs or grab an evidence bag to keep the chain of custody for all your valuables. Don't forget to follow our show on your favorite streaming app so you never miss an episode, and get photos and updates on our Instagram at Cousins on Crime Podcast or our Cousins on Crime Facebook page. Have a case suggestion? Email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.